Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, author, and journalist Ian Totten. I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our third look at the murder of Olivia Christian in 1981. Before we get going, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow me on social media, just look for the Deathcast, Deathcast Pod, or Deathcast Official. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do this. First and foremost, you can go to your favorite podcast app, follow the show, and leave a 5-star review. They really do help the show grow. Secondly, you can go to tinyurl.com/DCastPatreon and join the Patreon feed where you can get access to early ad-free shows as well as exclusive content such as the Columbine series, the Vince McMahon series, and the series we're currently in the midst of, a re-look deep dive at the Atlanta child murders. There's no subscription. You can cancel anytime. And for the month of December, you can get 50% off any tier, meaning the basic tier, the $1.99 tier, you can get for just $1, and you get access to all content that is on the Patreon. So again, that's tinyurl.com/DCastPatreon. And I do have to give a shout out to my first two Patreon members, Channel and Anthony. As always, you guys are awesome. I also need to shout out the peeps that are at the Deathcaster level, Debbie from True Crime University and Samantha. All right, now that all that's out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back and relax. I've got my coffee. I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. When we left off last time, police were still investigating Olivia's murders. They'd done a couple of different canvases throughout the neighborhood in Hampton where she had been found murdered. They'd also spoken with her boyfriend, members of her family, and were zeroing in on a man known as Michael, who was known around the apartment complex, and who they felt, because of things such as shaving off his mustache, the fact that some people within the apartment complex said he was a Peeping Tom, and he was believed to have had affairs with women inside of the complex, was a viable suspect. However, they continue to get leads on further suspects, each one of which has to be tracked down. Their efforts to find the person or persons responsible, however, were stymied by the fact that at this point in time, 1981, forensic was really in its infancy, and when they started getting the forensic evidence back, they quickly learned that there was no blood group in the evidence presented that did not match Olivia Christian's, nor could they use the fingernail scrapings that had been taken at the morgue, specifically the autopsy, to identify any suspects. The only piece of evidence at this point that they have which points to someone outside of Olivia's apartment was a hair which had been found beneath her body, which was determined to have come from a black male. Now, unfortunately, this hair was considered consistent with Michael Alliston. However, they're not going to be able to state conclusively that this hair does in fact belong to Michael. If you'll recall other discussions we've had on forensics, you'll remember that in order to get a 100% match, a hair has to be completely intact. That means from the tip of the hair down to the root, must be present in order to get specific DNA. In this case, they simply had a piece of hair. So it's like looking for a needle in a haystack as to whom this hair may have come from. Even with all of that, officers felt that they more probably than not had enough circumstantial evidence to go after Michael Alliston. However, when they went to speak with Michael, he informed them that he had spoken with a lawyer who had told him not to talk with the police any further. So the officers go back to Anita, who, if you'll recall, was the young girl who had witnessed a black male driving through the parking lot and then going into Olivia's apartment. She had also seen the man leaving and stated to officers emphatically that the man had the eyes of a monster. Now, because they believe so strongly that Michael Alliston is the perpetrator of this crime, they go and speak with Anita again, and her story doesn't change, which leads them to request that she come in and take a polygraph. The polygraph examination was found to be inconclusive. Some officers felt that this may be because she was being evasive or was trying to protect somebody that was known to her. However, I have to point out, as I always do, polygraphs are a pseudoscience that are not admissible in court because they are highly flawed and everyone's biochemistry is different. So you could have one person lie through their teeth when they are taking the polygraph examination and pass, and another individual who, for whatever reasons, outside stressors or high blood pressure, etc., will tell the truth and will fail miserably. And at this point, officers are kind of forced to turn their view away from Michael for a period of time, although they still believe he is the most viable suspect. However, every lead that they receive leads to a dead end. Suspects who are turned in to the police turn out having viable alibis, such as being at work or not being in the area during the time of Olivia's murder. Because of this, time and again, they come back to Michael Alliston. And according to Anita, officers kept coming back to her, putting pressure on her to identify the man that she had seen that morning as Michael Alliston. However, she steadfastly refused to do so. Many years later, officers would state that one of the biggest hurdles they faced during the investigation was the fact that so many false witnesses came forward during the course of this investigation, many of them not wanting to see an innocent individual be arrested and tried for a crime that they did not commit. It was also the fact that many residents in the Ivy Home apartment complex believed that the officers were, at this point, looking to pin the murder on anyone, and therefore they would not speak with the officers. And this goes back to the deep-seated mistrust within the African-American community of the police. It's not just limited to major cities. It's, you know, ingrained within the community's DNA across the nation, as there are countless stories and tales out there of officers using an individual's words, shaping them in such a way that they are able to go after them legally, where in reality, no legal recourse is justifiable. But it's deeper than that. Even individuals who have committed a crime, oftentimes the communities from which they come, they have a persecution complex against the police and feel that the police are unfairly targeting. Now, whether this is true or not is inconsequential. The thing does not have to be true in order for people to feel it, believe in it, or act upon it. A great example of this is Los Angeles, specifically Watts and Compton, where the majority of the residents feel that the police unfairly target them. This despite the fact that there is such high crime in the area, there is open gang activity and a very high amount of violent crime. That isn't to say that there may not be some form of racial profiling going on in these areas from the police, but very often the police are targeting an individual or individuals because they believe or have evidence to indicate that that individual or group has been involved in some form of crime. And because of all of these false leads, as well as individuals not being willing to talk to the police come out and publicly stated that Anita's composite sketch of the man she saw on the morning of Olivia's murder was more likely than not a lie, and that the public should disregard it. This is going to hamper the investigation further because, reality check, Anita did see this man and is later going to be able to identify him. But it does go to show how individuals can destroy the credibility of a witness just by giving the information that they do, which turns out to be false. It paints the whole witness pool with a tarnished brush in the eyes of law enforcement. On December 16th of 1981, another murder occurs roughly a mile from Olivia Christian's apartment. This was at 406 Worcester Avenue, when 46-year-old Mary E. Johnson, who was home alone at the time, was bludgeoned and then strangled to death in a manner eerily reminiscent of Olivia's murder. Now, obviously, the police community, as well as local news, noticed the similarities in the two crimes and were quick to point them out. In a local newspaper article, the then captain of the Hampton Police Department, Captain Godsey, stated, "There are similarities between this case and the Christian murder." Now, some of the differences are the fact that Miss Johnson was married to Reverend Jefferson Johnson, and according to the Reverend, when he came home that evening from having given sermon at church, he found his wife bludgeoned about the head with a necktie wrapped around her throat. And so scared did the community become that a local church offered a $5,000 reward for information leading to the arrest of the killer or killers. Now, the head of this local church, a Bishop Willis, stated, "We believe it could be the same killer. In our opinion, this is the work of a sick maniac." This served to jumpstart the investigation, with numerous tips and leads flooding into the police station as individuals sought to collect on this reward. Unfortunately, this had the opposite effect of what it was intended to do, as each lead in the Johnson murder had to be tracked down, pulling resources away from both Olivia's murder as well as Mary's. However, a break came in the death of Mrs. Johnson when detective learned of an individual by the name of Roosevelt Fitzgerald, who was an acquaintance of the Reverend Johnson. They end up doing a search of Roosevelt's apartment, and during the course of this search, they noticed that Roosevelt's girlfriend was wearing a very distinctive ring, which had been reported as missing from the Johnson home on the night that Mary Johnson was found murdered. Police quickly surmised that the Reverend Johnson may have hired Roosevelt Fitzgerald to kill his wife, and they promptly arrested him, letting him know that they were going to seek the death penalty. Johnson ends up copping a plea bargain wherein he admitted hiring Roosevelt to kill his wife and giving the man instructions to make the crime look similar to the murder of Olivia Christian. And so again, officers were no closer to finding Olivia Christian's murder than they had been on the day that her body was found, although they continue to track down every lead that comes in. And some of these leads were very far-reaching, including a burglary ring, which was said to be getting fed information from maintenance men on which apartments were the best for robbing. This particular tip stated that Olivia had been murdered because she had seen the head of this ring committing a burglary in one of the apartments inside of Ivy League. And officers later stated that every new method that came along during the course of Olivia Christian's murder investigation was tried out, including superglue fuming, which is the introduction of superglue fumes to items of evidence in an attempt to bring forth any fingerprints which may have remained hidden during the course of the normal dusting for prints. The FBI's Behavioral Science Unit also got involved and put out this profile, which I'm going to read part of. Quote, "The killer is a male, 18, 24 years old, residing with it in close proximity to the victim and probably walked to the scene. He will reside with his parents. While it is possible he completed high school, it is more probable that he dropped out. The individual is single and has never been married. It's unlikely that the offender owns a vehicle. He will rely on public transportation, bicycle, or walking as a regular means of transportation. The offender is most likely unemployed. If he is employed, it'll be with minimal interaction with others and involve evening hours. He has probably not killed before and has not previously been incarcerated. There is a possibility he has come to the attention of authorities for nuance offenses and burglaries. While the victim and the offender may have been passing acquaintances, it is not believed that they were well known to each other. The offender will have less than average intelligence and spends a great deal of time daydreaming. He has low self-esteem and consequently doesn't interact with others. He is a loner and will pursue solitary hobbies and interests. He does not take pride in his personal appearance. He may have a speech impediment such as stuttering or stammering. He is impulsive and acts without considering the consequences. He is a nocturnal individual who spends a great deal of time walking during the evening hours." So stymied were investigators in Hampton, they even submitted questions for serial confessor Henry Lee Lucas. Now, if you don't know who Henry Lee Lucas is, he is infamous for having been arrested in Texas on murder charges and confessing to hundreds, if not thousands, of murders throughout the United States. the majority of which were found to be false confessions, meaning that while Lucas did in fact commit some murders, he committed nowhere near the amount of murders that he confessed to, and he simply did it because it got him preferential treatment in prison. He was aided in this by his friend, part-time lover, Otis Toole, who may be familiar to some listeners as the primary suspect in the Adam Walsh murder case. Walsh was the son of America's Most Wanted host, John Walsh. I want to point out that although the Walsh family believes Otis Toole was the murderer of Adam Walsh, there is no conclusive evidence to state that Otis was in fact the murderer, at least nothing that has been made publicly available. As time wears on, unfortunately, Olivia Christian's case ends up in a file cabinet down in the basement of the Hampton Police Department with a cold case investigators looking into it when they have free time. It just seems to them to be the impossible case, the one that they cannot solve. And it's unfortunate that these types of things happen, even in today's day and age, with all these advances in science as well as technology, but they do happen. More so when it's a stranger-on-stranger attack. An interesting thing that came out, though, during the early to mid-1990s concerned John Preston. If you'll remember, he's the man that brought his tracking dog, Harass, to help the officers try and locate the area that the suspect had likely fled to. One of the original investigating officers who had remained in the homicide unit learned that Preston was a fraud and that he would oftentimes obtain insider information from those working the case and then cue his dog to track down or to follow a specific track to lead investigators to a specific location. In terms of those who were involved in this investigation, the only one whose life got better with the case going cold was Michael Alliston, as investigators became more and more convinced that Alliston was in fact innocent and had been innocent all along, and that John Preston and his dog, having obtained insider information, had intentionally led officers to Michael's home. Olivia's mother ends up passing away in 1990 at the age of 76, while her father, who found Olivia's body, passes in 1997 at the age of 91. Both of her parents went to their graves, never knowing the identity of their daughter's killer. So we're going to fast forward here a little bit. Olivia's case goes completely cold. There's not a lot of activity on it until 2011. When an officer by the name of Randy Meyer, who's working for the Hampton Police Department in their Crimes Against Persons Division, is assigned a cold case, the 1989 murder of Teresa Howell. Now, Howell had been raped and strangled. Unlike the case of Olivia, DNA was able to be collected from this particular case, and at the time of his involvement, Myers states that they had a long list of suspects that they needed to obtain DNA for, and that primarily became his job. He goes about getting DNA samples from all of these various suspects. And it's in the course of obtaining these DNA samples that he happens to speak with his father and tells him what he's doing and the particulars of this case. Meyer's father then brings up the Olivia Christian case to him. Now, his father didn't know the particulars of the case beyond the fact that it had taken place in the early 1980s and involved a school teacher who had been found strangled inside of her apartment. From talking to his immediate supervisor, Meyer learns the name of Olivia Christian. And so, on January 18th, 2011, Olivia's case is reopened. According to Meyer, after reading through the case files a few times, he realized that there was no connection between the 1989 murder of Teresa Howell and Olivia's murder. It's through all of this that Meyer starts surreptitiously looking into Michael Alliston. He's been told at this point by the former detectives that worked the case originally that Alliston was not a viable suspect. However, he learns that Alliston's brother, who was roughly 30 years old at the time, was a registered sex offender who had been convicted both in 1987 and again in 1994. And it's through Alliston's ex-wife that he learns that the brother, Samuel, had lived with them off and on throughout 1981. However, after interviewing Samuel, Meyer decides that he is not a viable suspect, as Samuel informs him that his crimes had involved minors and that he deeply regretted having committed the acts which he did. He comes across a number of other suspects as he continues to investigate Olivia's murder. Many of these individuals are either incarcerated or had been incarcerated at a prior time. One of these was Olivia's paper boy. Now, Meyer ends up zeroing in on him based on this paper boy's recollection of the events of that day, including what Olivia was wearing that day and the fact that she had been strangled with a electric cord from her alarm clock. Obviously, all of this information set off alarm bells in Meyer's head. However, as he continues to investigate this man, he learns from classmates as well as from his mother that this man has autism and is highly suggestible. He also learns that this man is extremely intelligent. And with all of this information, he comes to the conclusion that this man is enjoying the attention that he's getting in the Olivia Christian case and is almost certainly not responsible for Olivia's murder. Now, all of this eventually leads Meyer back to his eyewitnesses, specifically Anita Purcell. And while Anita initially agrees to help with this reopening of the case, she eventually decides that due to what had happened before, the tremendous amount of pressure that the Hampton Police Department had put on her to finger Michael Alliston, she is no longer willing to help the police solve Olivia's crime. And this is understandable, as the police had really jumped all over Anita in an effort to get her to either finger someone else for the crime or else recant her statement, which she eventually did because of the amount of pressure that had been put on her. This is going to change, however, after meeting with Olivia's brother, who writes Anita a letter. Now, Officer Meyer hand-delivers this letter to Anita's home, and the next day he receives a phone call from a hysterical Anita, who states that, quote, "That man is a monster, Detective Meyer. I know, I saw him." Meyer is then able to get Anita's cooperation in helping to solve the murder of Olivia Christian. And from here, events begin to stack, which are going to lead to the identification and eventual conviction of the man responsible for Olivia's death. Strange as it sounds, one of the first things to fall into place is the discovery that Olivia's brother Thomas still has an antique coat tree that had belonged to his sister, and Meyer obtains permission to have this tree checked for DNA as well as fingerprints, on a long shot that maybe there's something there that everyone else missed. Maybe there is, in fact, some form of evidence from 30 years prior that will link a perpetrator to Olivia's murder. So this hall tree ends up being sprayed with luminol, which reveals the presence of bloodstains at the base of the piece of furniture. However, because of the amount of time that has passed and how many times this particular piece of furniture has been cleaned in the intervening years, it is determined that there isn't enough blood still present to identify a DNA or blood type. It was after going through all of the various case files and creating what's known as a murder book in homicide detective parlance, wherein they organize all of the information from the various files into a cohesive narrative, that Detective Meyer came across a handwritten note on a sheet of paper with three words written on it: Susan Quinn, friend. Meyer was able to locate three women with that name who had lived in Hampton during 1981, and by chance he was able to find the correct woman on his first try. And the information he gleaned from Susan startled him, and he wondered why it had never been tracked down. He learned that a few weeks before Olivia's murder, the two women had been on the phone when, from Olivia's side, there came a knock at the door. Susan recounted how she heard Olivia go to the door, and after a brief moment, informed the individual who was knocking that she had not called maintenance. Susan stated that there was more knocking after this, before Olivia finally announced to this mysterious individual that she had not called maintenance, and if they did not leave, she was going to call the police. Obviously, this sent off alarm bells in Meyer's mind, and he began to wonder if this was a ruse that the killer had perhaps used to gather information on Olivia Christian, or if it was a method that he used in order to gain access to women's apartments. Detective Meyer starts to build his own profile of this individual with the facts that he has. He believed that the man was a stalker, given what Anita had seen concerning the man looking in the window of her apartment and going into the door, coupled with what Susan had told him on the phone. Based on this information, as well as the information other officers had gleaned from decades upon decades of siding violent crimes, Detective Meyer began to paint a picture for himself, not of a burglary gone wrong, but rather an attempted rape that had escalated to murder. His theory was that the perpetrator had not gone to Olivia's apartment that day to assault her. He had simply gone there to scout, to pre-plan his attack, and upon finding that the interior door was open, was unable to control himself and simply walked inside to lie in wait. He surmised that the initial assault took place inside of the living room where the man leapt out and surprised her, probably striking her in an effort to quickly subdue Olivia. However, Olivia began to fight back with the man, quickly retreating back into her bedroom in an effort to escape her assailant, that the man had followed her, and that Olivia had grabbed the alarm clock off of her bedside table and struck the man with it, which enraged him, at which point he had moved in and began striking her with his fists. Myers theorized that Olivia fought back, and he had evidence to prove this, as there were indications on Olivia's hands of bruising, indicating that she had struck her assailant repeatedly. There was also the fingernail scrapings, which proved that she had scratched the man. And in this theory that he put together, Meyer believed that the man eventually overpowered Olivia, although when she refused to succumb and simply let the sexual assault occur as the man was removing her top and bra, he had taken the pillow from her bed and shoved it over her face. However, she would not relent, and the man eventually picked up the alarm clock and began bashing her over the head with it, which led to the various cuts, bruises, and fractures to her skull. Olivia ended up being knocked unconscious from this. And again, according to Meyer's theory, the suspect then realized that it would be a fool's errand to remain and sexually assault his victim, as it was very possible that someone had contacted the police. However, he could not risk a living witness, so it was at this point that he strangled Olivia with the cord to the alarm clock before fleeing the apartment in a panic. Armed with his partial profile and the theory of how the attack occurred, Detective Meyer begins reaching out to nearby jurisdictions, looking for similar attacks that had taken place either prior to or after Olivia's murder. He also began visiting the Hampton Police Department's records room, where older case files were kept on microfilm. For those of us from an older generation, microfilm or microfiche was a machine where you would put cartridges or spools inside of, light would magnify through the back, and you could quickly scan through, you know, dozens or hundreds of pages in mere moments. Back before the internet existed, this is how many of us did reports when we were in high school. So he does this for most of 2012. And in December of 2012, he finds one report that catches his attention more than any others. It read, quote, "The man walked down the sidewalk past the apartment and was looking in the window. Then he put his hands on his hips, turned around, and walked past it again. He was acting suspicious, looking into the apartment window. End quote. Meyer, who by this point knew Olivia's case in and out, and knew Anita Purcell's statements to the police verbatim, recognized this as the exact type of behavior that Anita stated she had witnessed outside of Olivia's apartment. Meyer read on and learned that the victim's name was Denise Worley. And after pulling the full file, he learned that the assault had taken place on June 10th of 1982 at the Sinclair Garden Apartments in Hampton. The facts of the case were thus. Miss Worley was inside of her apartment asleep at 3 a.m. while her husband, who was in the Navy, was at work over at the Norfolk Naval Base. A man gained entry to their apartment by breaking the window on a door. This woke Miss Worley up. The man then punched her in the face and forced her head inside of a pillow to muffle her screams. He then pulled her shirt over her head so she could not see him, dragged him downstairs, and raped her. Miss Worley was able to contact police immediately after the man had fled the scene. And as police are descending upon the area, a patrolman notices a car acting suspiciously on a nearby street. He pulls the vehicle over, and the vehicle is being driven by a 32-year-old black male. The car was a 1965 four-door Ford Galaxy. The officer notices the man seems to be extremely agitated and evasive in his questioning, so the patrol officer calls for backup, and fairly quickly a sergeant arrives on the scene, and they observe broken glass on the man's shoes. They end up searching the man's car, finding marijuana and a very thick screwdriver that the victim later was able to identify as the object that was put to her mouth and told was a gun. The man ends up being placed under arrest, and Miss Worley is able to identify him as an individual she had encountered three times previously over the course of the last few weeks at a bait and tackle shop when she stated that she noticed the man staring her down and following her through the store and then out to the parking lot, an encounter with Miss Worley stated she informed her friends and family about, but also at her place of work, a nearby drive-in restaurant. On one occasion, standing at the back door and staring at Worley until a co-worker informed the man that he could not be there and must leave. Miss Worley then said, a few days after this particular incident, there was a knock on her apartment door, and when she opened it, the man was standing there and stated, quote, what shift does your husband work at the shipyard? I want to catch a ride to work with him. Miss Worley refused to answer the man's questions and shut the door. The man's name was Reuben Edward Moore. And through his defense attorney, Moore opted against having a trial by jury, instead deciding to have the judge act as both the judge and the jury. 14 witnesses ended up being called, two of whom described seeing the man walk past Miss Worley's apartment repeatedly, place his hands on his hips, and then peer into the window. Both of these witnesses also stated that the man looked around him in a somewhat suspicious manner each time he did this. Miss Hutton had taken the stand, stating that she was awoken by the sound of broken glass. looked out the window, didn't see anything, and went back to bed before being awakened by a man's hand over her mouth and the man punching her in the face before proceeding to brutally rape her. She said that the man forced her afterwards to go to the kitchen sink and wash her vagina to dispel any possible evidence that might be left. He then informed her that if she spoke to anyone about what had happened, he would come back and he would kill her and her children. She stated the man's last words to her were to not step in the broken glass and to lock the door behind him. Moore ends up taking the stand in his own defense, stating that at 3:30 in the morning he was out driving on his way to go fishing, and that the shoes he had been wearing were secondhand purchased by his wife, with the defense attorneys stating that possibly the previous owner of the shoes had left shoe prints found outside of Miss Worley's apartment. Obviously, that's not possible. The judge ends up deliberating for a very short period of time before he convicts Moore and sentences him to 30 years for rape and 5 years for breaking and entering to run concurrently. Now, obviously, Detective Myers is blown away by this information and decides to do a background check to find out if Reuben Moore is still alive. And he learns that Moore is in fact still alive and had been paroled from prison in 1997 after serving 15 years. At this point, Moore is 62 years old and residing in Hampton. Further digging turns up that Moore had been arrested only one time walking in Hampton's Greenlawn Memorial Park at 3:30 a.m. in 2007. Meyer ends up finding the booking photograph of Reuben Moore, and not surprisingly, Moore is an African-American man with a mustache sporting a navy blue ball cap. After getting some negatives that were inside of the envelope containing the booking photo developed, Meyer stood looking down at a picture of the car Anita Purcell had described in 1981, an aqua green four-door sedan with a faded top that was slightly lighter than the rest of the vehicle. The following day, Detective Meyer learns from an older officer inside the force that the name Reuben Moore was well known in the Hampton Police Departments, that he was a serial rapist and was held in such contempt that when Moore was released from prison in the 1990s, the then chief of police sent out a department-wide memo informing all officers that they needed to keep an eye on Moore. Furthermore, he learned that there was a murder which had taken place in 1972, that of Helen Sturgis, and that Reuben Moore was the only suspect in this crime. Sturgis had been raped and murdered inside of her home. She was an 84-year-old white woman who lived in an area in Hampton known as the Gold Coast, which is where the affluent resided. Sturgis happened to be house-sitting for a friend of hers at the time of the murder. From the detective that worked the original case, Meyer learns that neighbors had severely contaminated the crime scene, and the cause of death was from multiple stab wounds, which resulted in cardiac and pulmonary trauma, with the knife having been taken from the kitchen, something Meyer made note of as The drawers in Olivia Christian's kitchen had been pulled open and rummaged through, and it was the belief of the detectives working the case originally, as it was Myers' belief, that the killer had been in search of a weapon with which to dispatch his victim. There was semen present inside of the victim, although they could not get a blood type from the sample. However, a pubic hair was found on Sturgis's sweater. It was learned from a neighbor that a very distinct car had been seen parked in front of the house the evening before and the morning after the murder had occurred. Now, this neighbor also stated that she had seen this vehicle on a number of occasions. It was a black vehicle with a white top and resembled strongly a police car. Having nothing further to go on, the investigating officers had reached out to nearby Newport News. From these officers that they learn of Reuben Moore, who had been convicted of a very similar rape in 1968 involving an elderly woman who had been stabbed repeatedly and then left to bleed out. The victim had survived, Moore had been arrested and sentenced to life in prison. However, he had appealed the verdict and ended up being released on a technicality in 1971. Officers further learned that Moore had worked at an auto body shop where vehicles were routinely painted, and many of these vehicles were oftentimes former police vehicles that had been purchased at auction, and that sometimes employees of the shop would borrow these vehicles. However, they were never able to definitively link Reuben Moore to any of the cars from this paint shop. A search warrant is eventually issued for Moore's house, and a shirt and pair of pants are discovered covered in blood. Now, according to the original detective on the Sturgis case, they found Moore working as a bricklayer, and when they approached him, he had stood raising the trowel in his hand like it was a weapon, and it was only after they drew their guns that Moore dropped the trowel and was able to be placed under arrest. Moore ends up refuting everything that the officers tell him, and they end up having to get a court injunction to get blood samples as well as head and pubic hair samples from him. However, the blood samples that were obtained from the crime scene do not match Reuben Moore. The blood-stained clothing found by detectives had been washed, meaning that the type of blood was not able to be identified. However, officers learned from the FBI that the pubic hair, which was discovered on Sturgis's body, exhibited similar characteristics as the sample that they had been provided with. Because of this, because so much of the evidence had been destroyed, Reuben Moore ends up walking on this case. Now, Reuben Moore had an extensive criminal record dating back to 1965, and we're gonna do a quick dive into all of these various charges, some of which I have already briefly touched on. His juvenile record was sealed, but many believe that the crimes for which Moore was arrested included assaults on white teenage girls. At 16, having been released back to Newport News, Moore was the suspect in a string of burglaries. Then, on March 14, 1968, at age 17, Moore was arrested with attempted rape, burglary, and felonious assault. In this particular crime, Moore had climbed through the second floor apartment window of a woman who lived alone on Marshall Avenue. She woke to find him in her bed where he struck her in the face repeatedly and subsequently raped her. However, the woman's screaming eventually forced Moore to flee the apartment. Investigating this crime, officers discovered that Moore had unscrewed the light bulb outside of the house in order to operate in darkness. They also learned that this particular crime matched similar crimes that had taken place in the nearby vicinity in the weeks and months prior to this rape. Moore was positively picked out by the victim and tried as an adult. When authorities attempted to introduce the light bulb into evidence, Moore's defense attorneys objected, stating that Moore may have touched this light bulb at the store where it had been purchased. And amazingly, the judge agrees with them, and Moore ends up being found not guilty. 6 months after this, on September 26, 1968, 18-year-old Reuben Moore was charged with rape and attempted murder after a man who was later identified as Reuben Moore entered the apartment of a woman by the name of Minnie Selby. The man had used a unlocked window to enter Miss Selby's apartment and awaken the 74-year-old retired school teacher. Moore had then punched Selby in the face and proceeded to rape her, putting her head inside of a pillow and stabbing her repeatedly in the neck, ear, and hands. Miss Selby miraculously survived as she was discovered by a milkman making his morning delivery. Because of the horrific nature of this crime, police had done a door-to-door search and had discovered Reuben Moore living one block away from the victim. One of the officers recognized Moore from the other rape cases for which he had been tried. And detectives, learning of this, quickly seized Moore's residence, allowing no entry or exit. A warrant ends up being issued. During the course of this search, a knife is discovered covered in blood, along with a section of wooden handle being missing from the knife. The missing piece was discovered in the victim's home, lying next to her bed. Unlike other cases, everything was set to go against Moore at this trial, as hair, semen, and blood samples found at the crime scene matched him. He ends up being sentenced to life in prison, and he ends up appealing this conviction, which ends up going all the way to the state Supreme Court, where his lawyers argue that the affidavit used to obtain the search warrant for Moore, the search of Moore's residence, is faulty. As the officers writing up the search warrant had not specified what items that they were searching for. And believe it or not, the Supreme Court of Virginia agreed and the conviction was overturned and Moore was released. Within 6 months of his release from prison in 1971, a woman was raped in an apartment 7 units down from his. This particular victim stated that she had seen the man who she identified as Moore a week prior looking through the window of her apartment. She stated to officers that she'd seen the man again a few days later in her backyard in what she surmised was an attempt to intimidate her into not testifying. This so frightened the woman that she fled the state and did not return to testify against Moore, and the case ended up having to be dropped. In December of 1971, another woman was raped. During this particular assault, the victim's daughter, a young girl, walked into the room and was punched in the face by the assailant. The child's wails forced the man to flee the house. Investigators discovered that the light bulb over the back porch had been unscrewed. The victim stated that a few days prior, she had seen a man looking in one of the windows to the house, while the victim's mother stated that 2 days prior, a man had knocked on the door claiming to be a mechanic who had been sent to the home. She had turned the man away. Both women identified Moore as the man who had come to the house. This particular case ends up being thrown out because penetration could not be proven. Instead, being convicted of burglary and attempted robbery. We're going to end the episode at this point with Detective Meyer having learned a lot about the individual he believes was responsible for Olivia Christian's murder. I hope you guys have enjoyed this week's episode. Until next time, my D&Ders, stay morbid.